Welcome to After the Buzzer. We are back from a forced hiatus. What's happening here, big guy?
Well, here's what's happening. A behind the scenes look. Andrew Callahan, our good friend who covers the pitchers for the Boston Herald, we had hoped to have him on the last 2 weeks. But news keeps on breaking regarding the Patriots.
Yeah.
You know, obviously Bill Belichick parting company with the Pats, and he is out there and still not hired, which is shocking. And this, and just today, they hired an offensive coordinator because we had hoped to have Andrew on today. So hopefully next week for Andrew.
Anyway, we do have Mike Gross, that's me, Gordy Jones, that's him. We do have the man cave.
Indeed.
We do have heat. We have a heat source to my left.
Yes.
If you could picture that.
We have a new Packers-related decoration.
That's not, I've seen that program cover before.
It's amazing.
I love it. It's a pretty new one.
Yeah. So that's a new addition to the man.
That's game. A very like late 60s, early 70s graphics and design. Pretty cool.
So, yeah. So anyway, we're happy to be here. We're happy to be talking with you. And we should talk a little Super Bowl.
God knows we got plenty to talk about.
Yeah, so we want to talk about the two conference championship games, which is leaves us with the defending Super Bowl champion Chiefs against the 49ers, which is a rematch of the Super Bowl from a couple years ago, which was won by Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Different teams, in a case of the Niners, a different quarterback in Brock Purdy.
Yep.
And still Patrick Mahomes, you know, it's like all roads lead through Patrick, or they don't.
I'm not sure that we have a theme for this discussion, but I have a lot of little things. Here's one. Remember I said, this was when we were watching last week at the dispensing company.
Yeah.
I said, you know, Mahomes has never had really good yards per attempt, which I always look at first as a stat. I've been thinking about that because obviously he is an historically great player and he's a guy that we might end up arguing is the best ever at some point.
Could be.
That's possible. Yeah. So anyway, I suspect that some part of the fact that his yards per attempt is very ordinary most of the time and was on Sunday is that Big Red is still, at his heart, a West Coast offense guy.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And even though the West Coast offense was in vogue like four or five vogues ago, right? I mean, that's way up. I think that's still how he thinks. So his approach is, if it's third and five, let's design a play that gets six.
Yeah.
And Travis Kelce is maybe the best ever at that specific thing. We were predicting. I remember that one time we were predicting, what's going to happen? They're third and five. What are they going to do? Kelce over the middle of the field. Boom.
There he was.
So anyway, I think that may be part of the reason why that number doesn't quite work for Mahomes the way it has for every great quarterback.
I think that's fair. I mean, you know, he did have Tyreek Hill for a while, and still, as you say,
it was better than it is now, but not crazy.
Yeah. Now, here's an interesting thing to me. You know, the Chiefs' offense probably is definitely not as good as it was when they had Tyreek Hill. I mean, that goes without saying. But neither is the Niners' defense as good as it was when they played the previous time.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. I think that's true.
So I think it's kind of interesting, you know, that both units, you know, historically, you look at them as like off the charts. But that's not true.
I suspect that in the Niners' case, that's a personnel thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know their personnel well enough to know like what's dropped off, like who they don't have, who they did.
Well, they let their one starting safety got hurt, and he was really good.
Yeah, that's right.
The guy whose name I can't pronounce and won't even attempt to do so.
And Jair Brown from Penn State, who is, I think, no doubt is going to be a terrific player in the league. But he's not yet.
No.
I mean, he has some really good moments and he gets burned like most DBs in the NFL do at times. And he might be vulnerable a little bit. That's one.
Mm.
But I don't know. I suspect even the front seven doesn't seem
not as overpowering as you would expect when you have, you know, Bosa and Armstead and Chase Young. By the way, there was a piece of tape that circulated of Chase Young on the one touchdown the Lions scored. It was away from him. And he gave minimal effort, like chasing from the weak side, to the point that he like did some half-hearted,
like, and it was away from him.
Yes.
But He ended up right fairly near the ball. Close to the ball.
He should have made the play.
Could have made a play.
If he was running hard, yeah, it was on one of the lines.
He just checked out.
Boy, that was really, really telling.
I saw that too. Yeah, that's one of those things that it's the universal language of Twitter, and all we see all this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really it, because you just automatically say, "Oh, that guy Chase Young, he's a great player." Well, maybe not all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. He seems like. Bosa is a great player.
Yes, certified.
Without question. Mm-hmm. And the rare, the very rare NFL defensive player now who makes a play and gets up and gets ready for the next play.
What kind of sorcery is this?
That's crazy talk. I don't want to go down the old man, get off my lawn kids thing, but how many times do you see NFL defensive backs, they're getting shredded the whole game, just getting torched beyond comprehension. They force one complete pass, and they're looking at the crowd there with making the incomplete sign, like, "Oh, no, you're denied.
Look at me, I'm shutting down the field." Or not.
God.
Which is something, actually, to think of. I know going into the playoffs, before the Packers played the Niners, I read something that said that the Niners' two cornerbacks are very highly penalized. And, in fact, they were both penalized in the game against the Packers, which we won't talk. The less we say about that game, the better.
You brought it up.
I did indeed. But that's something to think about, too, given, you know, how, you know, offenses, the whole officiating or the game itself is geared toward offense.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But again with the D-backs.
Yeah.
Why do they have to grab? Why do they have to grab? So many times they grab the jersey, and I don't see where they're gaining any advantage.
Yeah, I hear that.
It.
Yeah.
That's strange.
And that's the obvious penalty. That always gets called.
Yeah. That's what the ref's looking for, like almost like an automatic thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You grab the jersey. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, look at Bradbury in the Super Bowl. It's like he didn't even get a good grab. It was just like the smallest of grabs, and that was like an automatic defensive holding game over.
Yeah, that was a famous one. I forgot about that.
So that's something. So who do you like in this game, Mike?
I like the 49ers a little.
I do too.
A little. Mm-hmm. I think Brock Purdy is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching the Pat McAfee show, a little bit of the Pat McAfee show last week.
Right.
And he was saying Christian McCaffrey and Brock Purdy, they're pretty athletic. They're more athletic than you think. Christian McCaffrey is more athletic. He is a beast.
He's a Hall of Fame player.
Unbelievably athletic.
Oh, my God.
Sounds like a white boy thing, except it's coming from a white boy.
I don't get that at all, because it's I never didn't think of Christian McCaffrey.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Purdy, I get it a little bit. But then you hear people. Then I saw some things. I don't know where you see all these things, but somewhere on Twitter or something like that, where they were talking about Purdy like he's not fast, like he was just waddling around out there. What are you looking at?
I mean, he did surprise me on that one run against the Lions, because I think it might have been Hutchinson, but it was one of the Lions' better defenders was chasing him, and he ran away from him.
Well, if it's the play I'm thinking of, Hutchinson got a good arm on him right at the line of scrimmage, and he went right through that.
I was impressed
with his strength on that. And then, you're right, outrunning people. He's not a great quarterback, but he's pretty good.
He's good enough.
And he's certainly athletic enough. His athleticism, his speed, jumps out to me. I don't know.
And they have guys around him that are just so good. McCaffrey being the foremost example.
Yeah.
But Debo Samuel's Kittle's a great player. I mean, these guys are like in the top five, and maybe at the very top of at their position in the entire league.
Yep.
I mean, those three guys are just great.
They've done a lot of things right, organization.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, that's a big piece of why they and I think we said this just recently, but I mean, they've been a little unlucky with injuries and stuff like that, where maybe they could have gotten a little more out of this run that they're on already. Mm-hmm. But it feels to me like they're ready to take the next step. And Kansas City is just not that team that puts 38-45 on the board. Yeah. They haven't been that for a long time, although This might be the best defense of of this era, you know?
Yeah, I think it is. I dare say it's the best defense that Andy's ever had, maybe even including his Eagles years. You know? It's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
They got a lot. I mean, Chris Jones is, Jones he's really speaking good. Of a top of his position group. I mean, he's as good as it gets. And they move him around, and Steve Spagnuolo does a lot of creative things that'll give you something to think about. Here's the thing about Purdy. I think he's played three good quarters out of eight in the two playoff games they played. The fourth quarter against the Packers and the third and fourth against the Lions. So I don't know what that means.
Well, yeah, the first half against the Packers.
He was rough. Yeah, was really not so very good.
But, you know, that was – he obviously really struggled with the conditions. I'm not making excuses for the guy, but, I mean, I think he struggled more than Love did until that last horrible interception.
We won't talk about that.
That was more, yeah. I'm
that
sorry.
Was, a, I mean, sorry, in any conditions, you don't make that.
That was more the decision.
I mean, this is a sidebar to our larger conversation, but to be honest with you, the thing that surprised me most about that game was how Love kind of came unglued at the end. I mean, he was not good at the end of that game, and he had been really good for literally 10 games.
Yeah. You know, he seems like a good decision maker. He seems like a guy who really has benefited from sitting and learning and developing and playing and getting better and gradually getting better.
The second half of that game, he was not good, though.
But
he was not good at all. And that surprised me because I thought temperament-wise, it seemed like all season, even when he was struggling, it didn't seem like the game ever got too big for him.
He seems very calm.
Yeah, it seemed like it got a little too big for him.
But the decision-making near the end was not calm.
No.
Not the product of a calm
mind. No. He that interception and the first interception was a bad throw, too.
Yeah. So,
but anyway, that's a sidebar to our larger conversation. Yeah, I think I like the Niners a little better, too, but the caveat is quarterback. You know, if Purdy plays like he did in the first half against the Packers or the first half against the Lions, they're going to get killed.
Yeah, that's right. And it's unthinkable. This is the good news, I think. It's unthinkable to me that the game's not going to be close. Yeah. I can't imagine it not being close. And the Chiefs have a defense, and they have that quarterback. They have that dude.
That's a lot.
I mean, and he's not going to screw it up.
No.
It's not an easy call. No. I'm kind of talking myself into the Chiefs a little bit here.
It's not an easy call at all. And we know, you know, Mahomes and Andy Reid, you know, they've been pretty good in Super Bowls, you know, as far as knowing how to, you know, even the previous one against the Niners, Mahomes wasn't playing well for literally 3.5 quarters. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, he was Patrick Mahomes.
He's had a lot of games like that.
Yeah.
Maybe not a lot, but he's had several that I can recall that were kind of, I thought, in that category.
Right.
Again, he is not going to be, if you look at it statistically, he's not going to have, you know, historically great numbers for the entire body of work. Mm-hmm. But the stuff he does, the plays he makes, the plays he extends, the ability to be so elusive while it doesn't look like he's moving that fast.
He's special. He really is. I mean, as impressive as he was in that Super Bowl, he was almost more impressive in that Super Bowl they lost to Tampa Bay where they're getting clubbed. And he was still trying to make plays. Even though his receivers weren't helping him, he was getting rushed. And he was like, oh my God, that was really impressive to me, how he competed, even though they were getting smoked.
He had no help from the wideouts and no help from the O-line in that game. Almost less than zero, negative.
They were horrible.
Yeah.
They couldn't block him at all, and he was not. He did not pack it in, not once.
Yeah,
and that was really impressive.
He's wired the right way, like I think mentally and emotionally, as well as insane physical talent.
Yeah. I mean, these guys, they're all like competitors off the charts.
Yeah,
that he's like even above that.
Yeah,
I think,
I think he is. I think he really is, and he just there's no off switch. He's just going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing,
And I thought it was interesting how, you know, they're trying to burn clock last week, and so they give him a throw, and he throws it to Marquez Valdez-Scantling, who has let them down again and again and again, and he's the guy that makes the play.
That wasn't a great throw. He's gotten a lot of credit in the media for that throw. That was an okay throw.
Right.
And a sort of goofy, wild, great catch.
Of all people.
But also, it was one of those, put it out there and give him a chance to do it, you know.
Yeah. So, again, this guy, he's a little different. So, that alone will keep the Chiefs in it, for sure.
I want to briefly mention, because I'm going to write about this next Sunday, so I don't know how much we want to belabor it, but this Taylor Swift nonsense. It's just, you know, these and I'm going to say it's right-wing pundits. It's loony right-wing cultural commentators, because that's what it is. 100%, that's what it is. I don't think we're going to get in trouble for saying that, you know. And 6 weeks ago, they were saying that Taylor Smith was a team wrecker and she was Yoko Ono. Yeah. And now they're saying the NFL is, the Super Bowl's fixed because of Taylor, because they're hitching their wagon to Taylor Smith. How can you let both of those things come out of your mouth?
It's amazing to me. This is interesting. Earlier today, I was listening to Ray Ratto, who's a San Francisco columnist.
Oh, yeah.
And a very good one. He was on Tony Kornheiser's podcast, and he was saying that those very people who are now saying those things about Taylor Swift are at a point where they now have to root for a team from San Francisco. Imagine the irony in that.
Yeah, they have to root for a team from San Francisco. And they have to root against a story that comes right out of the Hallmark Channel, one of those like traditionalist romantic, right? The pretty singer and the grizzled cowboy from the Midwest.
I love it. Yes,
and the colossal, monumental lack of self-awareness that what we just said doesn't occur to these people.
Yes, well, it speaks to how rapid news cycles are and how small attention spans are.
That's part,
right. You know, yeah. It's like we're not going to remember what happened 5 minutes ago, so we're just going to start a whole new narrative.
Yeah, but I remember what happened five minutes ago. But it's,
as we all should. Yes.
All right.
Well, let's move on to Joel Embiid. He's injured his knee against Golden State the other night. Didn't play in Portland and will not play tonight in Utah. And they still have not announced the severity of it, which sounds pretty ominous to me.
Yeah.
And this comes on the heels of a larger narrative where he sat out in Denver and that led to, speaking of narratives, oh, he's ducking Nikola Jokic. Well, I don't know why he would do that, and et cetera, et cetera. And the further narrative was the only reason he played against Golden State because he heard all this noise and said he wanted to put it to rest, but then he got hurt worse. Because he, even walking on the court that night, you could tell he wasn't right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't see enough of it. Yeah. I saw some of it, but I didn't see it.
He was not moving well, and he was not playing well in the game even before he got hurt. He was 5 for 18 from the floor. So now it seems like, you know, the Sixers season kind of hangs in the balance in some ways because, you know, they're not going anywhere without him. They might not have been going anywhere with him. You know, that was – but I would have been interested to see what would happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's not true to say they had as good a chance as anybody, but I think they're in the top. I think they were in the top five.
Yeah.
With a healthy him and a healthy Maxi.
Yeah.
Maxi has an ankle sprain. Right. You said right. Yeah, I don't think that's going to be an ongoing thing. I hope not.
No.
But I thought they put up a heck of a fight. Was it? Maybe it was that Denver game.
Yeah,
without both of them.
They did play well.
Yeah, I thought they played really well in that game. It's injuries. They're the wild card factor in all of this. We can break it down as much as we want, and if the wrong people get hurt, it's over.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, the newly enacted NBA legislation dictates that in order to qualify for postseason awards, you have to play 65 games. And Embiid, I forget what the number is now, but he's close to that threshold because he's missed at least a dozen.
Yeah, I think it is a dozen. He can still do it, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know if he's going to be back anytime soon.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. How do you feel about that? I mean, to me, 65 seems fair. I mean, it's like, you know, that's like roughly 2/3 of the season, I guess.
You're missing, you would be missing 17.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, there should be some limit. And, you know, people now are arguing, well, it should be 60. Well, I don't know. Is that big a difference? I mean,
that's arbitrary.
Yeah, it seems very much so. But 65 does not seem like an unreasonable number to me. But maybe I'm missing something.
Well, let me just before we get into the weeds of this, let me just say this one thing that I'm tired of hearing myself say. And I feel like this is almost like the disclaimer on the side of the cigarette pack.
There you go.
The NBA regular season is twice as long as it ought to be.
Right.
And the solution to this problem, if they cut it in half all of these problems would go away. And I am of the opinion that if they did that over the long haul, the NBA would be more profitable, not less.
Okay. I think that's fair.
Okay.
I mean, the one year, which year was it? 1998-99, when they had the strike and they played 50 games.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought there was a lot of appeal in that. You know, started on Christmas, play 50 games. Now, you might play back-to-back-to-backs then. That's a problem.
Yeah.
As far as, because that's hard on the body.
Yeah, you don't have to start in January. I mean, you can, it's doable. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's sort of.
But I don't disagree with you. I think the season is too long. I mean, only the series.
It's not only too long, it's way too long.
Yeah.
And I assume they started it this way way back in the day just to maximize gate, receipt, right. I guess. I mean, that has to be
it.
Yeah. And to be clear, it's not going to happen for a number of reasons, but one of them is that the owners, it would have to be collectively bargained. The owners are not going to say, well, we're going to cut 35 games off the season without you guys taking a pay cut, and the players are going to say, we're not taking a pay cut. So that would be an impact. Yeah. I mean, there's no...
As always, follow the money, right?
Yeah.
That's always the case. So,
yeah.
It's interesting to me, though, just the whole, I don't know, the length of the season. It does get to be, I mean, especially this time of year, it gets to be real drudgery. You know what I mean? Because it's like you really can't see the finish line, which is, you know, all the way in April.
Yeah, that's right.
And you certainly can't see the starting line, which is back in November.
Yeah, when I said there were all the problems he would solve, that's one of them. Here's an interesting thing about this. Wilt, of course, the statistical freak of all time in all sports, the year that he averaged 50 a game,
61,
he averaged more than 48 minutes per game.
Correct. That's right.
Yeah. More than every minute of every game.
Yeah.
Embiid was, this may be slightly off now, he was averaging more points per minute this season than Wilt did in that season.
Yeah, Embiid has said this himself. Anytime you get mentioned in the same sentence with Wilt, you know, you feel pretty good about yourself. And understandably so, because, you know, he still has pages of the record book, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And Embiid was averaging 36.
It came
down a little bit the last couple.
Yeah, when he scored 70, that pushed his average over 36.
Yeah.
So he's leading the league for the third straight year. So, yeah, he's a very unique player. And it is a shame that he's hurt. You know, and it was just a freak thing. I think it was Kuminga fell on his leg as he was on the floor for, you know, looking for a loose ball. So.
But we look at Embiid now and we think, it's not reasonable to expect him to play the number of minutes that players routinely did back then. So what's different?
That's a good question.
I don't think it's just the theory of load management, although that's part of it. I don't think that's just that.
I don't know, because back then, I mean, you think about it now, I mean, sports science has improved so much.
Yeah.
The, you know, conditioning has improved so much. Nutrition has improved so much. They don't have to travel on, you know, regular planes. They have their own charter planes. Yeah. They can leave whenever they want. They don't have to, like, you know, it should be easier, you would think.
This part of it, just being able to get through it, mm-hmm. should be easier, you would think. And then you have Bill Russell playing every game with low top chucks on.
That's right.
How about that? That's incredible.
You know, you think about, I think about this every now and then. It's like the perfect basketball body. And that was it. Bill Russell, LeBron. There's a couple guys in that discussion.
Yeah.
And there's a guy that was built to play basketball. It's like just the very sleek, you know, not overly muscled. Yeah. Whereas Embiid, he kind of shuffles up and down the court. You know, I think of like when Jeff Rulin played. There was a guy with a big upper body and really small legs. And he ultimately suffered a lot of leg injuries. It's just like that body wasn't built to run up and down a court 100 games a year, you know? Speaking of the length of the season.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So
that's right.
That part always interests me.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. I mean, I can see, you know, I mean, Wilt got to play against Daryl Imhoff and those, but that shouldn't affect your ability to play the minutes.
Right.
Right.
Right. It should not.
Here's
how they're similar too. What they said goes too. I mean, I think whenever Embiid says he wants to play, he plays.
Yeah.
And Wilt you know, obviously dictated that all the time about, you know, what he was, how much he was going to play.
But what Wilt dictated for most of his career was, I'm never coming out.
Yes, correct.
not
right.
Not I'm going to,
right. Yeah, right.
I need a rest.
I think it was Harvey Pollack once told me that Wilt came out at halftime and said, I had one more assist in the first half.
Wilt looking at the numbers.
Wilt knew what he had.
Perhaps unduly concerned with the numbers.
Well, I mean, the record would certainly strongly suggest that Wilt, of all people, was... I was actually at a high school game. I won't say what team it was recently, and it was a losing team, a team that has not played well this year locally. And right. A friend of one of the players was saying, you know, bantering back and forth, you know, at halftime as they're about to take the court for the second half, and the player said, "Oh, I had 11 points in the first half," and it's just like, you know, why are you overly concerned with that, dude? You're getting smoked on
your
score.
Butt's kicked, buddy.
Yeah. So you can say that's a generational thing, but in a lot of cases, I don't think it is.
That's universal.
That's universal.
And, you know, it's not that crazy to have it in your mind.
Sure.
Yeah, I scored a little bit, but don't say it. We don't want to hear it.
No, we don't want to hear it. I mean, you know, again, it's a high school kid, so.
There's a lot of things like that. But you can think it, but don't.
But Wilt was certainly a poster child for that. He was a guy that was concerned about the records, concerned about his impact on the game, which, you know, kind of leads to the whole discussion about greatest of all time. Everybody goes Michael, LeBron, and I always say, well, Wilt belongs in the discussion. But, you know, then again, you look at it, he won two championships, and there is that. He was overly concerned with the, you know, his own numbers. And here's another thing. You know, he never fouled out of a game. But I remember watching games back then when he got five fouls, he just stopped playing defense.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. So, you know, what does that benefit not fouling?
Yeah.
So where do you stand on the GOAT discussion, Mike?
Oh, man. The Wilt is such a unique set of... I remember this is really interesting, I think. In Bill Simmons' book of basketball.
Yes.
He let Chuck Klosterman, you know what I'm talking about, Chuck Klosterman,
sure.
Sort of a pop culture writer, I think a really interesting guy. Dave Jones doesn't like him, but
of course he does.
He let him write a piece about Wilt.
Yeah,
and he said Wilt could probably, with a little different attitude and a little different way of thinking. He could conceivably have been Russell. Russell could never have been Wilt.
That's a good point.
Just could it was a the piece. That's essentially what the piece was saying. It was that argument fleshed out, and that's true.
Yeah.
But what does it mean? What does it mean about basketball? What does it mean about sports? That Russell got all the rings, and that's the object of the game.
Think about this. Wilt's second title came with the 71-72 Lakers, where they asked him not to score. And that was an all-time great team. They won 33 games in a row. There's a record that I dare say will never be broken.
That'd be tough to break.
Yeah.
That's almost half a season going undefeated.
Yeah, so the only time they asked him to score was in the finals against the Knicks, where, you know, the Knicks won game one, where they made all these shots.
Yeah,
Jerry Lucas
right.
stepped out, Dave DeBusch, all those guys made shots. So then they just said, dude, you got Jerry Lucas on you. Just go be Wilt. And that's what he did.
And I think he had two really big games in that series.
Yeah, I think you're right.
One of them was the second last one, if I remember.
Yeah, I'll have to look at it.
Well, he had a game in that series where he went for 45, I think.
Yeah, I'm
anyway,
sure you're right.
And the other thing was about that team was Jerry West was in a shooting slump.
Yeah.
At the end of the year. I was a huge fan of that team because I was a Jerry West guy.
I was
rooting for that team like crazy. And then the other thing about that is, at the beginning of that season, Elgin Baylor, a historically great Hall of Fame player.
Speaking of people who don't get enough notice, great player.
He retired.
Yeah, and then that's the most
streak
started.
Season, and they got better.
Yeah, because
they got better when he retired.
Yeah, Jim McMillan, Elgin still thought he was as good as he used to be, and that was a problem. So then
he was replaced by Jim Millen from that basketball factory,
Columbia
University,
known for its journalism school of all things.
That's right. That's right.
So that was Jim McMillan was a really good player. Gail Goodrich, who was in the Hall of Fame, and speaking of underrated players,
yeah,
that was a great player.
And he might have led them in scoring.
I think he did. I think he did. And of course, Happy Hairston was on that. He was the fifth starter on that.
And Hapster was sort of a power forward-ish guy.
Yeah.
Coached by Bill Sharman.
Who won an ABA title and an NBA title.
And they beat Milwaukee in the semis.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
With Kareem.
That was Kareem. Yeah. That was, and then the Knicks surprised him in the game one of the finals, but that didn't last. So yeah, I'm looking up your.
Did that finals go five or six?
Five.
You know what the 45-point game might have been.
I'm looking
in
looking.
That series with the Celtics.
Really?
In the couple years before.
Okay.
That series with the Celtics that went seven games.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that might have been.
All right, here's this. Yeah. All right, yeah, they won. They lost game one and then won the next four.
Yeah.
I mean, historically great teams. This has got to be one of them. I'm not seeing the 45 point. I don't think it was that
soon. Yeah, maybe it was.
But at any rate, they did ask him to score more as the series went on, and then the Lakers roll. I don't know. A lot of people, you know, that's another one that's hard to figure, the greatest NBA team of all time. I mean, I think that team certainly belongs in the discussion, but, you know, there's so many Russell teams that were great. People mentioned the 82-83 Sixers, of course. They mentioned the 66-67 Sixers, speaking of Wilt.
Yeah.
And speaking of historically great players all around him, you know how.
And I believe they went 68-13, which means they only played 81 games.
I don't know why that was. Yeah. I never knew that.
Yeah, and we're pretty dominant in the postseason, and of course I had to get past Russell Celtics to get to the finals. I think they played Golden State in the finals.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Yeah, so that was Nate Thurman and Rick Barry and those guys. Damn good team.
Well, yeah. I would vote for the 86 Celtics.
I think that's a good call.
Yeah.
And speaking of Simmons' book, that's the way he goes. Now, here's my problem with the whole thing about fans or journalists admitting their fandom. It's like Simmons made his bones as the Boston sports guy and has been unabashed in his fandom. So when he says that, how much weight does that carry?
Yeah.
You know?
That's true. He would push against that. He would say that's an outmoded idea. But you can all... I listen to his podcast all the time. I like him.
I do too.
He's had an unbelievable career. Yes. He's had the greatest career for a sports writer ever.
Yeah.
Without question.
And he's an unbelievably creative guy, an unbelievable forward-thinking guy, and knows his NBA history inside and out. I would never...
And that book of basketball is wonderful. That is a wonderful thing. That's one of those books that if you like basketball and you like the NBA, you just pick it up and open it up anywhere.
It's like a 500-page book, isn't it?
Yeah. It's so many. It's... players ranked, and then lengthy assessments of the players.
One of the things that rankles, and again, it gets back to his fandom, he doesn't rate the 82-83 Sixers as high as he might because they lost the next year in the first round. Well, what does that have to do with it?
Yeah,
That's stupid.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of teams that they're not one-shot wonders. Certainly that Sixers team was not a one-shot wonder, but it all came together one year.
Right.
Well, and then it didn't come together the next year.
Right.
I mean, you know how teams are built. It's they can be, the chemistry and everything else can be elusive and is sort of delicate. And so I thought the Sixers team was one of the great ones.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, if you think about it, it probably wasn't as deep as people make it out to be, and not as deep as some of the other great teams, including that 85-86.
Yeah.
I mean, the 85-86 Celtics, they had Scott Wedman, who had been an all-star elsewhere, and he could barely get on the court for that team.
I think they had eight guys on that team who had been all-stars or would be all-stars.
Yeah.
Including all five starters.
Yeah.
I mean, Danny Ainge made an all-star team, at least one. That team was unbelievable. They may not have been as athletic by today's standards, but what a front line.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Which gets into the whole thing about how difficult it is to compare eras and styles of play, because obviously, you know, the Warriors during the recent run, a ridiculously good team, but if they played in the 80s, they would just get pounded instantly. They would just get pounded.
But what would the teams in the 80s do now?
Well, they wouldn't be able to play with those guys.
Yeah.
So if you're trading, I mean, it's simple math. If you're trading two for three, you're gonna lose.
Right, that's right. So that Warriors team that had Durant, was it 17?
Yes, 17 and 18, yeah.
That certainly would be, they would be on the short list. They would be top five, I think.
Boy, what a fun team to watch. Yeah. It's just like, and the fact that, that Ego didn't enter into it, that they just seamlessly kind of incorporated Durant into the mix and said, okay, Kevin, you go be Kevin, but we'll figure out the rest of our little stuff too. You know?
Yeah, and that feels to me like, I like Steve Kerr a lot, but that felt to me more like the players.
I think Kerr. So, especially Curry.
Yeah.
Because there's Curry, a guy, if your best player is not threatened by this guy coming in, then everybody else kind of falls into line.
And it didn't impact Curry or even Klay Thompson that much. Nope. If you go back and look at the numbers, I mean, his number of touches and shots didn't drop off that much. So they would be top five. And you know, the best of the Jordan Bulls would certainly be in the top five.
And which is also an argument that people get. It's like if those Bulls played today, or the Warriors of recent vintage, the Warriors wouldn't be able to score because Michael and Scottie were such ridiculously good defenders. But then, again, the game was so different then. Yeah. It was so much more physical, so much more compressed.
They were ridiculously good.
Oh, my God.
I'm not downplaying that.
Arguably the two greatest perimeter defenders of all time the same team.
Two guys on the same team.
Yeah.
Two on the same team.
Supplemented by a great front court defender, first Horace Grant and then Rodman. Yeah. I mean, Horace Grant probably doesn't get as much due as he should because he was a great player for them as well.
Yeah.
And yeah,
Rodman was a freak, but he was really good at what he did.
He was.
He could do a few things incredibly well.
Yeah.
And he was smart.
He was
a smart basketball player. He seems like a moron in life, but
yeah, well, that's a whole different discussion. But yeah, so I think we've covered the ones that would be in the discussion. Certainly, you know, pick a Russell team. I don't know which one we have to
in fairness to the Lakers. I mean, maybe one of the Magic and Kareem teams.
Yeah, I don't know
and
which
maybe
one.
Maybe one of the Kobe Shaq teams.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. The
Kobe Shaq teams should have been more dominant than they were.
I think so.
Where they lost the finals to Detroit. I mean, there was some dysfunctional family stuff going on there.
It's kind of amazing to even think about how they lost to those guys.
And they got swept.
Yeah.
They got swept. And you could tell that they were dysfunctional. They were struggling. They were Kobe and Shaq weren't getting along. But they in the Western semis, they played a really good Spurs team. It was a really close series. I thought they were a little lucky to get by, but they did. And then they got swept by Detroit, which was a very good team, but not.
Not in this discussion that we're having right now. I mean, speaking of the Spurs, I mean, which of their teams? I mean, is it the Duncan Robinson things, or is it one of the ones with Manu and Parker and Duncan that would be in this?
I would tend to think the latter, although it's not I'm not sure about that.
No, I'm not either. I mean, I'm tempted to say the one in 2013 that took Miami apart in the finals. I'm tempted to say that one, but Duncan was kind of past his prime, and he would, speaking of guys who don't have ego, who kind of like willingly passed the baton, you know, to the group, you know, it's like, and you know, which is again to his credit. I think he's, you know,
to his credit, but you know, he just wanted to win. Yeah. And that's what everybody should want. You just want to win. It's almost a Russell like thing, you know, with Duncan, I think.
It's fair. Because he really evolved, because at the beginning of his career, he was really a lights out scorer. And then he kind of like, as his game kind of declined, he willingly became like a role player plus. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, that's right. That's a good way to say it.
So
it's interesting. We're falling into something here, which is a natural way of thinking, which I think impacts the way people assess the 83 Sixers. Mm-hmm. They did not have this 3 or 4 year run. We're talking about teams that, you know, Kobe and Shaq. Well, which one of the teams which one are we picking to be one of the great? Same with Magic and Kareem. To an extent, same with the Celtics.
Right.
But wedged within there in the 80s was that 1 year where the Sixers were phenomenal, but they didn't have that 4 year run where we think, well, we have to pick, you know what I mean?
I mean, I think about this 2 years later, 84, 85, they had five Hall of Famers on their team and Andrew Toney. And they lost.
Who would have been a Hall of Famer if.
Yeah. Yeah. And they lost in five games in the Eastern Finals to Boston. Yeah. That's how good Boston was.
Yeah.
They lost in five games.
Those Boston teams. But they got beat more than once in the finals by the
league. Yeah, I mean.
After 86, I think they dropped off physically a little bit.
McHale
had the back problems. And,
No, Bert had the back. McHale had the foot.
Well, he played with a broken foot, but I think he had back trouble. I remember he had back trouble.
You're probably
Bird,
right.
You're right. The big thing with Bird was the back.
It was kind of a shame, but it was an interesting era because, the Pistons had to go through Boston to get their titles, and then the Bulls had to go through Detroit to get their titles, and that was a really interesting time.
Yeah, that was, but before that, you had Lakers, Celtics.
Every year, and then
except 83?
Yeah, because Magic ended up winning five titles, and Bird ended up winning three. So, which is never to diminish Bird at all, because
the other thing about Bird is one. I believe this is right. Right in the middle of his prime, three MVPs in a row.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Which very, very, very rare, and I think a lot of people now kind of think Magic would rank ahead of Bird, but I don't think that was the thing when both players were in their prime. I don't think that was the consensus at the time.
I think I'd have a hard time picking one over the other.
Yeah.
I really would. They were just both so amazing.
And in some ways, they were like yin and yang of each other, personality wise, style of play wise. They made a Broadway play about their relationship. Which I don't know anything about other than that it exists.
So, speaking of Kevin McHale, you wrote a story the other day about post-play in which you interviewed a couple guys from local colleges. One of them was Josh Parra, who plays for F&M, and we saw him last week against Gettysburg just have a great game doing a lot of the old school stuff. Yep. And you asked him if he ever heard of Kevin McHale, to which he said, he was like some coach or something.
And the kid from Millersville also, Drew Stover, I asked him the same question, just not to put him on a spot or anything. And they were fine with it. And you think about it, I mean, they are too young. It's hard to think about how young people are now.
When you think about it, okay, so they're probably no more than 22. So they were born in 2001.
Yeah, that's right.
Well past the Kevin McHale expiration date.
Would you like to be depressed on it? Glad to be in service. Yeah, so that's right. And actually, McHale did coach, although I don't think Parra really knew that. And the other thing about that story is this is the thing we've both run into many times in our careers doing features. It ran on Sunday's paper.
Right.
On Saturday, Millersville got beat by 20, and Stover fouled out in 20 minutes and had 0, 0-for-3 from the field.
Tip for donut.
0. Perfect times.
Yeah, so my wife often mentions that to me when I write a feature about how wonderful some guy is, and then invariably that happens.
I actually watched some of that game on the live streaming. They were at East Strasburg, which is very good and has a couple of post players also.
Right.
And then I looked at that box score and I thought, oh my God, he had 0. He had 0. How can you have 0?
Dude, help me out here.
Dude. It was sort of interesting that, especially in that PSAC, Division 2, everybody's got a guy like that and everybody tries to feature him. Everybody tries to pound it inside, which is one reason why that's a really physical brand of basketball and hard to officiate, I think.
Mm-hmm. Which is something you experienced last night. You saw Millersville play last night, and they won kind of a game marked by fits and starts because of the second half officiating. And you said it very much switched, which is something we've both seen over the years, how I think officials get in the locker room at halftime. They said, well, we need to call it closer or vice versa. And the two halves tend to be officiated very differently, and that's what you experienced last night.
I've seen a lot of games, and this happens a lot, I think, at the high school level in those big games at Hershey Arena with big schools, like back in the day when it would be York and Harrisburg or Reading and Harrisburg or whatever, and the refs know that they're working this big boy game, and they go into the game thinking to themselves, you know, we're going to let them play. Mm-hmm. We're just going to let the, we're going to let these kids put on a show, and we're going to let them play. And then the kids just beat the shit out of each other for 5 minutes, and they realize, I got to start stepping in, or this isn't going to be basketball.
Right.
So now it's that arbitrary whistle. It's that, you know, if that, why not that, blah, blah, blah. And then a lot of times they get in there at halftime and regroup and think, well, we got to keep control of it. We got to, and then the reins get tighter and tighter as the game goes on. And that doesn't serve the game well, I don't think.
Yeah, it just underscores how hard a job it is.
Oh, it's unbelievably hard. We don't want to come off like we're totally ripping the officials.
No, not at all. I think it's really
incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
It's so hard that nobody's good at it. Really, almost. I mean, it's so hard.
Mm-hmm.
How many basketball games have you seen of the thousands and thousands that we've seen in our lives? And there have been a few, but how many in your life where you consciously thought at the end of the game, it wasn't just that you didn't notice the refs, but you consciously thought, those guys did a great job and they enhanced this game. It has happened, but I'd say less than 5 times in my whole life. It's just so hard. I say that with sympathy for the refs, you know?
Recently, I interviewed Braden Bohannon, who's but plays basketball, also plays quarterback at Lebanon Valley. He's just starting his officiating career. And he said his first game was like a 7th grade game at Spooky Nook. And he said, A, he couldn't believe how nervous he was. And B, he couldn't believe how different it was to be in that. You know, have the whistle in your mouth as opposed to be playing. Just a whole different perspective. Yeah,
it really is. It really is. It's funny. I a couple years ago, they were given a class in how to officiate. The guys, the LL chapter, our local chapter, were given a class, and then they did a Zoom thing, and they kind of like asked a whole bunch of questions that would be on the test.
Mm-hmm.
And Braden, I participated in it and took the verbal, it wasn't the official test, but the verbal version of the test. And so did Braden Bohannon. He was on the Zoom too. And the test is not that hard.
Right.
I mean, you and I could easily become refs in pretty short order.
Right.
But doing it, actually doing it, is so, there's no way to fully prepare you for it, I think.
You
just have to get out there and do it.
Mm-hmm. Like, he's one of his mentors is a guy named Keith Evans, who's been a long time official.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So Keith said that one of the things that young officials need to learn is not to watch the ball, because, you know, your zone, if they're inbounding over there, you need to watch over here, on the right side, as opposed to the left side of the floor. So it's
based on working in a three-man crew and getting your positioning. Yeah.
So he said that's the one thing that young officials need to really condition themselves to do, to, like, you know, stick to your part of the court.
We just did a big piece on A1.
That's right.
The shortage of officials.
Yes.
That was an interesting thing, because it evolved into a different thing than we originally thought it was going to be,
mm-hmm.
because of the football situation, which I don't know if we want to go down that road. But anyway, one of the things that kind of hit the cutting room floor from that was that when they went to three-man crews, which is probably 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when the LL went to three-man crews, the local chapter was somewhat divided on it. Some of them said, let's do three-man crews so we can do it better and we'll take a pay cut.
Hmm.
They took a pay cut in order, and that thinking prevailed. Some of the guys didn't want to do that, didn't want to take a pay cut, and it has evolved to the point now where they're all making, it's all three-man crews, or virtually all,
mm-hmm.
and they're making way more money than they were 20 years
Interesting.
Ago. I mean, substantially more, not a ton of money. You're not getting rich, but substantially more money. Yeah.
Interesting, yeah. Keith said that locally, their recruiting efforts for officials are good, but he said guys get out of it after 2 or 3 years. And he said it's, you know,
so they give it that much of a shot and then get out.
Yeah, he said his take on it was that, you know, it's either in you or it isn't, which is an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm sure time commitment, I mentioned time commitment to him, but he said you can work as much or as little as you
want.
Yeah,
that's true. It really is not. If you have anything like the temperament of it, I guess I would urge you to try it, because you can work, You can make some money doing it because you can work a ton of games.
I've heard that.
There are guys, believe it or not, there are guys who are full-time officials who make a living at it, who do college, high school, and then camps and clinics in the summer. And you can go to these AAU events, you can go to these things at Spooky Nooks and work 3-4 games a day.
I know that, yeah, that's what Braden said. The first time he officiated back in March, like nearly a year ago, he worked 3 games his first day at Spooky Nook.
Jump into the deep end, kid.
I think so. So it's an interesting thing, and it certainly isn't for everybody. Because I can only imagine some of the idiocy you have to deal with, you know.
Yes, yeah, there's no doubt. And even these coaches. I mean, Casey Stitzel is a great guy, and I think he's doing a great job at Millersville. But it's just an ongoing discussion for the whole game with him, with the officials, and he's bringing them on.
Exhausting.
It is exhausting. And what can you say? At some point, I thought he hit him. You know, at some point, it comes down to that, doesn't it? But I don't know. I'm not saying a lot, Casely. Really, a lot of college coaches, or maybe the majority, are that way. Even if they're not real hostile about it, you know, every time this guy walks by, I'm going to get in his ear and start.
I mean, you know, I think making my case. If you're a coach, don't you have to pick your spots? Won't you get more of a fair hearing if you talk up, you know, occasionally? Wouldn't a referee be more inclined to listen to you if you know, once a half or twice a half? Wouldn't he say, well, maybe I really did miss that one?
You would think so. You absolutely would think so. Although I would say, I think the more veteran officials are more likely to tolerate that.
Yeah.
If you're not going nuts, if you're not yelling and carrying on and waving your arms around, our buddy Pat Flannery, of course, had to rein it in. And at one point in your career, if you'd have seen him, you would say, this is reined in? Are you kidding me? But seeing him in his first year as a head coach at Lebanon Valley College, which I did at some length, I mean, he recognized, I think, pretty quickly.
Yeah. Dude,
I've got to rein this in for the good of everybody, including my own sanity. Yeah,
you're right, though. Reined in for Pat is a very relative term.
You're talking about a competitor.
Oh, my goodness, my yes. God. So, yeah. So Pat, speaking of Pat, he's landed on his feet. He's, what, their NIL guy at Penn State now?
Yeah, I would really like to talk to him about this. I wonder if he would do... he might not do the show now.
Right.
Because he's got to be, you know, it's really, he's really with
him. Which is a shame, because he's been a great guest the last couple of years.
Yes.
Breaking down the NCAA tournament on a granular level. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, absolutely. He's been terrific. And really, maybe he can't follow it quite the same way now. I don't know. I don't know.
And we have a couple months to figure that out.
Yeah, and also, I would just like to talk to him about that job. What's he do? I'm not sure what that job is.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he has a background in development from after he quit coaching. Job he had at Bucknell.
Right.
But yeah, that's
yeah. So he's I guess, you know, he's working in lockstep with his former player Mike Rhodes, who's the Penn State coach, and they've had sort of an up and down year. They just got their first road win at Rutgers, so good for them.
You know, that was a good win for a couple. I thought for a couple of reasons. Number one, Rutgers is pretty good, and that guy's a really good coach.
Yes, agreed.
So, and if I looked at that box score, they shot the ball horribly.
Mm-hmm.
Penn State shot it horribly. Rutgers shot it horribly, too. Penn State forced 20 turnovers. Rutgers had 20 turnovers. So, to me, that's the disrupting sort of rock fight sort of style that they've got to do to win in that league. So and they did it without their leading scorer.
Interesting.
Clary did not play.
Wow.
Ace Baldwin had a good game. That one kid, the one big kid they have who has, he's at his third school. He's been at Georgetown and Maryland. Something like Quadra is the first name. And
I'll
then
find it.
And it starts with a W. Last name starts with a W. I was on a radio show the other day, and they wanted me to talk about Penn State basketball. And when
you've seen one game this year.
When I was ready to get on, the host was like, do you know how to pronounce this dude's name? Because I'm not sure. And we, you know, kind of butchered our way through it. but anyway, my point is,
yes,
he's one of these guys that has the rebounding gene. He has not had a very good college career, as he's bounced around. Mm-hmm. As I said, this is a third college that he's been to.
Is it Quetis Wahab?
That's him.
Okay.
That's him. But he had, I think he had like 15 points and 12 rebounds. He is becoming a guy who can give them some of what they need. I think you've got to, they've got to be.
He's from Nigeria, by the Lagos, Nigeria.
Yep,
was Hakeem Olajuwon. He's averaging 9-8 on 63% shooting.
Yeah.
And he shoots free throws well, 74% at the line. Yeah. So
he has become, I think he would be one of the few guys, I hate to say this, but one of the few guys on that roster who has exceeded expectations. It's such a cobbled together roster.
Yeah, indeed.
Because of the situation. So many guys transferred out. The roster had to be built through transfers. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're getting a guy from Maryland or North Carolina, you're probably not getting a guy who's all conference at Maryland or North Carolina, you know, obviously.
Well, this interests me because he started out at Georgetown, spent 2 years there, then went to Maryland, then went back to Georgetown.
Yeah.
And now he's a senior transfer to Penn State. That's
well traveled. It's a nomadic existence for the guy.
That's crazy.
I'm rebounding, will travel.
That's right.
So anyway, I'm rooting for Mike Rhodes.
Of course.
And I think what has to happen is he has to turn this into something like what Bob Huggins did at West Virginia.
That's good. I like that.
That's got to be the style. Yeah. Maybe even go way back, Nolan Richardson at Arkansas. That's how he's going to have to do it. And you know, he just doesn't have the type of bodies to do it yet because he couldn't. He couldn't possibly. So it's going to be a project. So every win they get, I'm kind of relieved by it, you know, because you hope that he wins enough to get the chance to build it to what he really wants.
Yeah,
it to
I
be.
Mean, I think we probably won't know, you know, what he's going to be and what their program is going to be for another couple of years until he has guys in. Because this, as you said, it's a cobbled together roster with a lot of transfers, a lot of guys from different places trying to figure it out. And they haven't quite figured it out just yet.
No, they haven't. And they have a couple. I mean, they lost to Bucknell. I mean, mm-hmm. Bucknell's not even good for Bucknell right now.
Mm-hmm, that's true. They haven't been for a couple of years.
No, they haven't. They had a 14-point lead at home against Minnesota last weekend and blew it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not stopping people the way they need to, mm-hmm. to dig out wins in that league. But last night was an exception. That was exactly the kind of rock fight kind of game that they've got to create to have a chance.
Yeah, the final was 61-46, which even sounds like
that's what it sounds like, right?
So
and 20 turnovers. That's such a big number. For them, I think. Yeah.
It is. So I think we've reached the end of our journey, Mike, unless you have something else for the good of the order. Oh, I know. This is completely out of left field, but recently in the topic of things you should watch, recently I've started watching Last Chance U, which is about the East Mississippi Community College.
Oh, I've heard about that.
It's a little dated now, but only a little. It goes back to like 2015. It's a pretty incredible piece of work.
Now, where did we find this?
I had heard about it, and I just, out of curiosity, I started watching it, and it was just like...
I mean, like what? Like literally, where can we find it?
Oh, I'm sorry, on Netflix. It's on Netflix. Okay. So I just started watching it, and it's just kind of amazing just how far inside this program they are, and just the footage they have of kids just being kids.
You know, it really is teams. That team dynamic, the social structure of a team, is endlessly interesting.
Yeah,
it really is.
And that's how this
is. If you can get inside it. It's hard to get inside. They gave him access.
I mean, every now and then the coach is a guy named Buddy Stevens, who is exactly the kind of Southern guy you would expect. And so every now and then he says, I don't want you around me right now, because he's like raging on the sidelines. Okay. But they're right there. They're in this academic advisor's office, and her like trying to cajole some sort of academic progress out of these kids. It's kind of amazing to watch.
Yeah.
It's really kind of riveting.
That sounds good.
I highly recommend it to you and anybody who might be. Really kind of amazing.
That's good. Recommendations. Yeah. That's what we want. We used to do that.
We should do that more. But I thought it was really, I mean, again, it's been out for a while, and I just decided to watch it recently. I'm kind of riveted.
It's called?
Last Chance U.
Last Chance U, and it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
And
it's East Mississippi a community college, and they've sent guys to the NFL like via bigger schools.
Yeah, right.
But you know, I find myself sitting there, and they'll be showing this guy who looks like a good player, and it's like, well, what happened to him? And then you go and you look it up, and it's so. And they've Jaron Reed, who plays for Seattle, he went there. There's a couple other guys that have. The guy in one of the guys in the documentary, a guy named Dakota Allen, he was on the fringes of the NFL, but a lot of the guys who look like really good players just, you know, they go the wrong way too. So
that's how,
but to me, the hero is this academic advisor, this woman named Brittany Wagner, just like trying her guts out just to get these guys. Look, if you can just pull a 2.5, you can go and play at X university.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That's, and it's the like, point. They have no interest in this, but she's trying. Oh, you know who's in there? Who's the one guy? He was at Penn State. Kamonte. Who's the defensive lineman? Oh, shoot.
Oh, man. I don't know.
Okay, you're going to have to filibuster.
I'll filibuster. I can do it. Well, you know, that the whole academic side of it. And the admission side of it.
Kamonte Carter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he, because I think he said in the documentary he flunked a couple drug tests at Penn State, so, and he ended up down there.
Down there, okay. So, and on TV. Yeah,
so, and he does not come off well at all. He really doesn't. He does not come.
Like the project.
The defensive line coach, like every now, like apparently this kid, he literally badmouthed the female managers during practice. So the defensive line coach is, you know, understandably having none of this, who he makes Carter roll the length of the field on his side and back again. And even having done that, Carter shows no remorse whatsoever for calling these managers bitches or whatever. Well, it's like, oh my God, it's really, in my mind, it's really compelling television.
Yeah, it sounds good. There's so many pieces of that whole mix that we never get any exposure to.
Mm-hmm. And here's the other thing, that this school is in Scuba, and years and years ago, the great Frank DeFord wrote one of his classic pieces for Sports Illustrated called The Toughest Coach That Ever Lived. And it's about a guy who coached there in like the 50s.
Yeah,
so I'm having read that just because of this series. So speaking of recommendations, if you want to go read a great story, read that. Because Frank DeFord just crushes it, as he always did.
As he always did.
Yeah.
So, and no more Sports Illustrated, by the way.
There's a sad commentary in and of itself. Well, and speaking of Tony Kornheiser, he had Pat Forty on today, who still works for Sports Illustrated, and he's like, you know, beside himself because he doesn't know. And our friend Mark Rogerich, who also does stuff for them, you know, it might be like, you know, 2 months from here and it's gone.
Yeah, it might be. It could be gone. It seems like the website is still churning out a lot of stuff. I don't know. But
Steve Rushen just wrote a really great story about Las Vegas for whatever Sports Illustrated is now. Yeah. Because that's where the Super Bowl is. And it's like, basically the gist of it is, how did this not happen until now?
Right. Well, part of it is the betting. The whole thing with betting. Yeah, that's changed. That landscape has changed 1,000,000%. But yeah. Wow.
That was a tangent. We went from East Mississippi Community College all the way to Sports Illustrated Vegas.
That's how we roll. That's how we roll. With a stop off in Vegas. All right. Okay, that's it, gang. So, it's been fun. And next week, the Holy Grail.
Andrew Callahan,
we hope, from the Boston Herald to talk about Belichick.
And the Super Bowl,
and other things. Yeah.
And how the Packers are going to win next year's Super Bowl, of course.
No, we're not going to do that at all. So don't get your hopes up, people.
We might have technical difficulties if we don't.
Oh, okay. All right. He's wielding the technology. All right, gang. That's it. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See you.
See you later.